had some of their young citizens urinate in a bucket.
Prepare to experience the strongest radio allowable by law. Secrets will be revealed. Myths dispelled.
From the studio gym where excuses never apply.
It's Superhuman Radio with your host, Carl Lenore.
Hey, hey, welcome back to another episode of Superhuman Radio. And today is Monday. People keep bugging me to say the date and day. Monday, March 13th. And today I'm very fortunate and very honored to have Adele Moussa on the show for a long-awaited Subversity Science Roundup. How you doing, Adele?
I'm doing fine. I've just recovered from a cold, but otherwise everything is okay. And I'm the one who's on it, quite obviously.
Well, I have been, last night, both Elisa and I woke up in the middle of the night not feeling well at all. She was kind of running a little bit of a fever. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it was something we ate or, but yeah, I am really under the weather today. And I got to tell you something. I hate to do this. I know it's like a shameless pimp, like, okay, Carl. No, it's God's honest truth. We have a new sponsor coming aboard that makes a product called Da Vinci, and it's probably the first nootropic I've ever taken that I actually feel something from it, like clarity. And I took one about an hour and a half before the show, and I got to tell you something. I don't think I would have been able to do the show today. I felt that bad. So there you go. There's a shameless pimp job. Hate me for it. Anyway, we have a lot of great things to talk about. There's a lot going on. But before we get into that, I've had an anniversary. Adele was kind enough to comment on the anniversary. We did our 2000 show last week. But really, I think that the volume of work that you put out on Subversity.com, it needs to be honored, even if it isn't an anniversary. How long have you been writing the blog now?
Oh, if I knew that, I would estimate about 5 years from the very earliest blog post. And actually, all that has more or less also been inspired by listening to Superhuman Radio, because I thought that it was so great that you had all the actual authors of studies on, and that you could rely on information that is not BS because it has been summarized by somebody for a supplement company. And since there was no place where I could find information like that online, I started to summarize the things I could find. And I guess over time I got sort of addicted, and therefore I'm putting out such a volume of work. I really like looking at my inbox. I have subscribed to all sorts of interesting journals, and whenever I get email alerts for new articles, I'm browsing through the tables of contents and selecting the articles I like. And I have two different categories, the ones I just mentioned on Facebook and the ones I actually want to write about. And I guess that all the articles which end up in the folder with articles I want to write about, I write only about 1 in 10. Because, time is a valuable thing, and I'm willing to sit in front of the computer all day. And there's obviously my real job as a teacher currently. So I still manage to write an article every other day, roughly.
You know, I've told people without knowing that this is the case that I believe that Adele writes those articles in one sweep. I'm sure you go back for some cursory editing of words that are typoed, but pretty much you have an amazing control over the colloquial English language, the vernacular, so to speak. I mean, you are a master communicator, but I have to believe with the body of work you do and the fact that you are a full-time professor, you have to write these in one shot. Am I wrong about that?
No, that's correct. And meanwhile, I'm using a tool that corrects the grammar for me while I'm typing it. And that helps tremendously, because previously people have often been complaining that there are mistakes when I'm writing a sentence and then decide to end it differently than I initially thought. And sometimes you forget to correct the connectors or things like that. And meanwhile, a tool is doing that for me. So I hope that at least the number of of typos and other mistakes has decreased recently. But otherwise, I'm actually writing, starting to write, and that takes me, depending on how complex the article is, something from half an hour to sometimes, if I'm doing extensive research while I'm writing, it takes me 2 hours. But generally, it's just from A to Z, so from the very first word to the last word in one sitting. That may be different sometimes if I'm writing review articles, but many of the articles deal with one study and some extra research that is related, and in those cases, I don't have to go back to the article. And sometimes you realize that when you read it, because it could be, or the structure could be improved if I had gone back to the article and revisited everything. But the question is, do I have the time, and is it worth spending the time, or wouldn't it be more interesting to take a look at another study, so that not 1 out of 10 of the interesting studies actually make it to the website, but rather maybe 2 or 3 of them.
You know, but I know that you never brag about yourself, right? And that's a really nice quality, to be humble about your own work. But I feel compelled to say that I don't think you realize the talent that you have in distilling down information and focusing on the salient topics within that information, and writing it in an easy to read and actually quite enjoyable and entertaining way. You know, you're entertaining. There's chuckles when you read some of your articles. And I don't think you have a fair appreciation for how talented you really are. And I'm just saying that. You know what I mean? I know there's a lot of smart guys out there over like at the ISSN boards and stuff like that. But I don't think that you realize, because you do all that and then you have a full-time job that takes a lot of time. I just wanted to say that. That's all. I'm not looking for you to respond. I just want you to know that. That's how I feel about it.
Well, I want to say thank you, and I really appreciate that. So that's all I can say about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm so humble, as you said.
let's do this. Let's move on to the first topic at hand. We're going to cover a few topics. It's going to be a fun show. So the first one is, we all use whey protein powder in some way or form, way, shape, or form. No pun intended. You posted a blog recently about mercury toxicity. Is your whey protein worse than your amalgam fillings? Talk about that. What led you to this topic to begin with?
Well, as I said, I subscribe to a couple of journals, and this was one of the study was mentioned in one of the emails I got. And interestingly enough, this is one out of, I've seen at least 3 different studies about the quality of whey protein, and all of them are strangely not coming from the US or from Europe, but rather from Brazil. And in that study, the scientists simply bought 19 different whey protein powders from the market. Unfortunately, as usual, the brands are not disclosed. So we just know that there's number 1, number 2, number 3, etc. And they tested them for mercury, so whether there would be mercury in them or not. And quite intriguingly, the amount of mercury is non-negligible. So it is not a toxic level of mercury, but there is more mercury, for example, in the amount of whey protein powder you would put into a regular shake than in the amount of in bread or other regular foods you would eat, or cereals or oils, fats, preserves, nuts, and other foods you would eat. So I thought that it is quite interesting to know that, even though you would probably have to drink roughly almost 200 shakes a day in order to get over the safety level that has been set by the WHO. So it's not dangerous in terms of you are supposed, or you are probably getting too much mercury. But if you take a look at and compare that to the amount of mercury that's probably going to leach from your amalgam fillings, if you have several of them, then the amount is comparable. At least if you trust the lower estimates of the daily amalgam exposure from fillings.
So that's what it's compared to. It's so is one shake compared to one day, or the time it takes to drink the shake compared to the amount of mercury vapor that's released in that same time frame? How did they come up with this equation?
Well, actually, I came up with the equation or the comparison, rather.
Okay, okay.
The study doesn't compare that. It simply gives you some values. And if you take a look at the values, you will see that compared to the, they only compare to the maximum level of safe intake.
Okay.
And if you do that comparison, it's relatively, or it's actually really low. So, on the other hand, people always wonder or worry about the amount of mercury that may be leaching from the fillings in your teeth. And therefore, I thought it would be interesting to compare that. And a comparison shows that the amount you are getting from a single shake of whey protein per day can be, if you have the brand with the highest mercury content, it can be in the range that or in a similar range as the amount of mercury that you will be swallowing simply because it's getting out of the fillings in your teeth.
So, but over a day, in other words, one day's worth
over
of...
Over a day, right.
Okay.
So if you compare that, or if you say, I'm drinking one protein shake with roughly 30 to 40 grams of protein per day, and if you compare that to the amount that is probably released from the mercury in your teeth...
In a day.
That is basically the same.
Okay, so why is there more mercury in these protein powders? Because they're concentrates of an original... food that if we tested the original food, it would be comparative with some of these other natural things like nuts. But because we're kind of reducing it down to and concentrating just the whey protein, we're getting a higher amount.
I would expect that it's exactly this. Although it's possible that some of the mercury could be transferred into the whey protein during the processing, you can see that, for example, cream and butter also have much higher concentrations of heavy metals than milk. So as soon as you remove the water, so to say, and you process it and distill fats or proteins, you simply increase the relative amount of mercury. And as far as the differences between the protein powders, which are quite significant, I'm going to publish the article tomorrow. I actually held it back to talk about it before, so people can take a look tomorrow. The differences are quite significant, and I've been trying to find out what the reasons could be. And it's really difficult to tell. If you look at the amount of research that has been done on dairy and heavy metal contamination, it usually comes back to where the cattle are
grazing,
where the cattle live.
Yeah.
So if that is a region where you have a lot of environmental toxins, then the dairy and the milk they produce will also be full of the corresponding heavy metals. And there's also no real advantage, for example, of being or of having grass fed versus grain fed.
Sure, because the grass and the grain is probably growing in the same fields next to each other, so it doesn't matter.
Right, exactly. And the environment or the direct environmental exposure is also a thing that must be considered. So in general, you will find there are only a few studies that actually compare that, but sometimes, or for two of them, the ones I found, actually the pastured dairy is more contaminated because on the pasture, on the grass, you will have more of the mercury from the surrounding if you get your dairy from a farm that is next to industrial manufacturing or other things like that. So this is not something you can rely on. And unfortunately, as I said, I don't even know if the products they tested have been imported from the U.S., from China, or
right.
been produced directly in Brazil. And therefore, it's really difficult to tell whether this is a problem for your personal whey protein or whether it is not. But what is quite interesting is actually that one thing that can help with mercury toxicity in general is to get enough selenium. There are regions in the world where you have a naturally high level of mercury, or due to industry or other man-made reasons, there is a high exposure to mercury, and in several of those regions, scientists have conducted studies where they gave the people selenium in its natural form, so an organic selenium in a relatively low doses of 100 micrograms, which is roughly the RDA. And the studies conclusively show that the amount of mercury that the people ingested obviously didn't increase, but the amount of mercury they excreted in their urine increased significantly.
Right, and that's because that's because selenium binds to mercury in the methylation process and allows the liver to get it out of the body. Right.
Yeah. So in general, it's good to keep an eye on the selenium intake. Although I want to emphasize that as far as the amount of mercury in whey protein is concerned, that's certainly not something you have to worry about, because it's much lower, for example, than the exposure you would get from a single meal with fish. And fish is still the number one dietary source of mercury. And even though it is, there's plenty of evidence that eating fish with the mercury in it is still more healthy than not eating
fish. There's only two fish on the planet that do not have equal or greater selenium content than mercury, and that is hammerhead shark and something called tilefish, which is a bottom-feeding fish, I believe, that lives in salt water. All of the fish, tuna, salmon, they have equivalent amounts of selenium in their flesh, in their muscle flesh, as they do mercury. So that's why it's not a big problem for people to eat fish, except when they... Oh, and the other thing is whale blubber. Whale blubber has less selenium than mercury in it. That's the other thing, and that's why the Inuit get themselves in trouble, from what I understand. But anyway, so the interesting thing about this, Adele, is the dairy and the study was done in Brazil, and they have the solution, the Brazil nut.
Yes, of course they do. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Although you have to be careful, because the levels of selenium in Brazil nuts stay very extremely.
Yeah, yeah.
So sometimes you have you can eat one nut and the risk of selenium poisoning, and sometimes there's almost no selenium in the nut. It really depends on the level of selenium in the ground, or where the plants are, or where the selenium nuts are coming from.
So
you can't really rely on that, but they are certainly a very good source of selenium.
Look what you're pointing to. Everything goes back to the earth, right? If the cows are eating, whether they're eating grains or grasses that are grown in an area where the soil has a lot of mercury to suck up into the plant, you're going to have higher mercury. And the same thing in the Brazil nut. So if you're buying Brazil nuts from an area that's very industrial and it's being rained down upon by particulate matter that's coming out of manufacturing smokestacks around it, your Brazil nuts are going to have more mercury in them too. It really comes back to the quality of the earth, doesn't it?
Certainly. And the earth also influences the amount of mercury in the drinking water. So if you're unlucky in living in a part of the world where the drinking water is high in mercury, the relatively small amount that you add from whey protein may matter, because one thing we shouldn't forget is that eventually it's not the amount of mercury or other toxicants you consume with a single food, but rather the total exposure. And that's something the scientists also mention in their paper, that the mere exposure from whey protein is really negligible, so we don't really have to care about that. But if you eat, let's say, 20 food items where the mercury content is negligible, if you just take a look at the one food item on its own, you can still run into trouble, because overall you get a much higher exposure then.
Right.
And another thing is that whenever we're talking about those things, we take a look at one official or another official recommendation of a level of, for example, mercury you shouldn't get in your diet on a daily basis. But there are no real established upper limits for combinations, for example, of mercury, lead, and arsenic.
Oh.
I mean, if you have only one, it may be perfectly safe to get X amount of mercury. If you combine that with a load of arsenic and lead, you may run into trouble, even if all the maximum intake levels are adhered to. So in this regard, we are still, or there's still a lot of research that has to be done, not just for heavy metals, but also for other things like plastics, like PPA, and the new replacements, which are not much better. We always have these upper intake levels for a single item of these, but never for combinations, which may be even worse.
And you know what else I suspect? We're learning more and more that the microbiome can actually influence nutrient uptake and as well as vitamin and mineral uptake. I would suspect that the microbiome also picks and chooses which heavy metals it wants to take up. And if you have a skewed microbiota, you may absorb more mercury from the food. That's something that no one's weighed in on yet. We always talk about the microbiota, about the good, the vitamins and minerals, those are good for you. But I bet you it influences the bad things being taken up as well.
Actually, there's already evidence that it does so, because most of the part of the most of the amalgam of the mercury in the fillings actually is inorganic, and in general, inorganic mercury is not as toxic for us as organic mercury, because organic mercury can pass the blood-brain barrier, so it can go right into our brains. And the interesting thing is that scientists have found that bacteria, which are usually found in our saliva, they can convert the inorganic mercury to organic mercury.
Oh, crap.
And thus, at least the early estimates, where people were just estimating based on tests in a laboratory setting how much mercury we could get from amalgam fillings in terms of especially organic mercury, they have been underestimating the amount, because you have to take into consideration what happens within your oral cavity and the microbiome in your oral cavity if you actually want to know the impact in terms of organic mercury, and thus the potential risk that the mercury is accumulating in your brain or other organs as well.
You know what? And I still have quite a few amalgam fillings. I need to get rid of them. We have to take a break. We have to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, we're going to change the topic. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about how exogenous insulin that many doctors prescribe for their type 2 diabetic patients may actually prevent them from ever being able to get better. We're talking with Adel Moussa. This is the Subversity Science Roundup. If you've never been to subversity.com, oh my God, do your brain a favor. Go there now. We'll be right back.
Dessert again with the new 100% natural line of high-protein, low-carb Quest protein bars. I love lemon cream pie and strawberry cheesecake, but you can choose from chocolate peanut butter, coconut cashew, or cinnamon roll as well. No matter which one you try, you'll feel like you're eating dessert. But this is no ordinary dessert. With 20 grams of high-quality whey protein isolate, 17 grams of prebiotic fiber, and sweetened with stevia, these bars will make you feel like you're cheating, but you're not. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Quest Protein Bar banner ad to learn more about these clean and delicious protein bars.
The benefits of a ketogenic diet are immeasurable. Health, resist disease, mental function, and even performance. But getting into ketosis can take weeks, if even at all. Now you can get into ketosis in 10 minutes. KetoCana is the first ketone powder that has been clinically shown to switch you into a ketogenic state by providing a rush of ketones into the bloodstream. Like to train fasted or want to spare more muscle glycogen during workouts? Take a shot of Keto Cana and hit it hard. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Keto Cana banner ad today.
There are a few products that I believe in the way I believe in CanSee eye drops. I've been using CanSee for 6 months now, and the changes in my vision are nothing short of amazing.
Wow, that's an old commercial. The truth is, I've been using CanSee eye drops for 11 years now, and I credit CanSee eye drops as being the reason that I do not need reading glasses at 58 years old. CanSee eye drops improve the quality and health of your eyes indefinitely. That's why I both use and endorse CanSee Eye Drops. Go to wisechoicemedicine.com and learn about how CanSee Eye Drops can improve the health of your eyes and the quality of your vision today.
Few products can boast being considered the food of the gods by the Aztecs, but the ingredients in Bio Superfood have been. Some algae are the most efficient forms of nutrients, proteins, minerals, enzymes, fatty acids, antioxidants, and much more. Bio Superfood is something you have to experience for yourself. That's why, for a limited time, buy any Bio Superfood products and save 15% off your first order. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the banner ad to read the research and learn why Bio Superfood is the best supplement in the world you're not already taking.
Individuals and businesses with tax problems, listen carefully. Do you feel like you're losing control over your finances? If you owe over $10,000 in back taxes or have unfiled tax returns, we can help you take back control. The IRS is the largest and most aggressive collection agency in the world, and they can seize your bank account, garnish your paycheck, close your business, and file criminal charges. Take control of your tax problems now by calling the experts at Tax Mediation Services and take advantage of the Fresh Start program and new laws that may allow us to negotiate a settlement for the lowest amount possible. Our team of tax attorneys and enrolled agents can stop collections and get you protected so you can take control of your financial future. Tax Mediation Services is accredited by the Better Business Bureau. Call now for a free case review and a price protection guaranteed quote.
Call Tax Mediation Services now at 800-616-0820. That's 800-616-0820. 800-616-0820.
Hey, this is Carl. Start your day just like I do with a high-dose lipospheric vitamin C from Livon Labs. You too can benefit from Livon Labs' lipospheric delivery system. No more pills or powders. That's outdated technology. Livon Labs has the world's most efficient vitamin delivery system, period. Learn a lot more today at liveonlabs.com and benefit from their new reduced pricing. That's liveonlabs.com, L-I-V-O-N, labs.com.
Alaskans agree that sockeye offers the truest salmon taste. Over decades of fishing Alaskan waters, Vital Choice has rare access to the very finest of these fish. Vital Choice sockeye comes from smaller harvest regions with fewer boats and faster processing. So our sockeye is flash frozen within hours of harvest to capture its fresh caught quality. Rich in flavor, omega-3s, and vitamin D, our most popular salmon also abounds in astaxanthin, the potent antioxidant that provides its vibrant red hue. Save 15% off. Go to Superhuman Radio and click the Vital Choice banner ad today.
This is the Superhuman Channel, where brawn and brains finally meet.
Welcome back. So, just a heads up, I got messages from listeners. You'll get a kick out of this, Adele. So, I got some messages from listeners who told me that the Adam and Eve spot, you know, the adult sexual pleasure store spot was keeping them from listening to the show when their kids were around. And I want to reach kids. I really, really do. I'm not kidding around about that, because all the bad people want to reach kids, you know, the crappy food manufacturers and everything else, right? So we need to reach kids too. So we pulled the Adam and Eve spot because it's more important to keep the listener happy than the sponsor. And believe me, I'm in no position to be giving up money, just for the record. Okay. I'm not a wealthy man. But then people said, well, they also cringe when they hear the healthy man spot about the little blue pill. And so I was like, okay, we pulled that too. So I just want everybody to know, if you ever hear a spot, don't email me and say, oh, that manufacturer sucks. But if you ever hear a spot that you feel offends you, it's offensive, you just need to email me and let me know, and we'll get rid of it. Because I serve you, the listener, not the sponsor. So you won't hear those annoying spots anymore. So bring the kids back in the room, and let's turn them into superhumans as quickly as possible. So we have Adele Moussa here with us from his blog, Subversity.com. This is the Subversity Science Roundup. The next thing we're going to talk about is exogenous insulin. This is a really big one, because doctors go right there when their patients stop responding to things like metformin, right?
Yeah, mostly. And actually, if you look at the safety profile and the long-term results in terms of does it get worse or not, insulin appears to be still one the go-to drug, even though now new drugs like the GLP-1 mimetics are available and may replace insulin. The standard treatment for people who do not respond to metformin simply is still insulin. And it also appears logical. I mean, you are one of the people who always argue in favor of testosterone replacement with regular testosterone. So
right.
It would only make sense to replace insulin if diabetes was actually a lack of insulin. But unfortunately, it is not. It's only a relative lack of insulin because the amount of insulin a diabetic will need in order to stimulate his cells to take up glucose is actually much higher than somebody who is trained and very insulin sensitive. And everything, or not everything, but much of it eventually comes down to skeletal muscle insulin resistance. And this is also what the scientists who conducted this interesting study that has recently been published in Nature actually looked at. They took a look at the skeletal muscle of type 2 diabetics, and what they found is that usually you would see a something like an up and down in terms of the regulation of certain genes. You would have, in a healthy individual, you would have genes that are favoring anabolism and the increase in protein in the muscle. And you would have phases where actually those genes would be switched off and other genes would take over that control process that's called autophagy. And you could think of that as cleaning up the debris and the making sure that everything is still working fine and replacing broken parts of the cell and things like that. And what the scientists in this particular study found when they looked at their patients was that the longer the patients had been on, or those patients who had been very long on insulin therapy, in those patients, the genes that are responsible for this process of more or less making sure that the cells work properly and cleaning up metabolic mess, so to say, those processes were, or the genes that regulate those processes were not really active. And the study has a couple of limitations. This is the first study that is investigating that specifically, and therefore the conclusion that this tells us that patients on insulin, they can't recover, quote-unquote, on their own, is still preliminary. But the mechanism the scientists suggest is very interesting. Because if you take a look at people who are, quote-unquote, only insulin-resistant and who make it and actually change their lifestyle, lose weight, start working out, and become insulin-sensitive again and avoid becoming type 2 diabetic or even have been classified as diabetic and later on recover, one of the most important things in them is actually that their pancreas and their skeletal muscle becomes or reacts normal again and repairs itself, so to say. And for this repair process, this process of autophagy is also very important. So if using insulin is actually switching that off, which is
right,
what this study clearly suggests, then you can exercise as much as you want because you're not going to get this benefit. Because one of the main benefits of exercise and of fasting, for example, is that you trigger this process of autophagy. And if you're not doing that, then this one very important stone in or step within the repair and healing process cannot take place. And therefore, the hypothesis of the researchers is that this can actually block the whole recovery. And this is also something we have seen in many studies before, because those studies all say the longer you've been on insulin therapy already, the less likely it is that with lifestyle interventions or other things, you can actually get rid of type 2 diabetes as well. And previously, scientists often thought, well, if you have been sick so long and have been taking insulin, quite obviously, probably your pancreas is so damaged already that you can't recover. And this study actually suggests that maybe you will have to go to a certain point where you actually get rid of the insulin again and use other types of therapy. Metformin, for example, actually promotes autophagy. because it activates the exact opposite of those proteins,
right,
which are responsible for the accumulation of protein in the muscle, and starts, if you take metformin, it rather promotes those processes of repair and cleaning up. So somebody who has not yet ventured into the or has not yet had to take insulin because he's still being able to control his glucose levels with metformin is, and that's also supported by science, much more likely to actually be able to get back or get off any medication if he changes or she changes his or her lifestyle significantly.
Well, first of all, the idea of giving a type 2 diabetic insulin is kind of like the analogy I like to think of is, let's say you have two people and one person is talking very, very, very loud and the other person starts to lose their hearing because of this loud talk. Instead of trying to solve the problem of the person losing your hearing, you say, okay, we'll just get two people to talk loud. So we're going to bump it up. And that's how the problem started in the first place. When somebody's pancreas peters out, giving them insulin is like going, okay, we're going to keep taking you up the scale of what's wrong with you. We're going to take you deeper down that rabbit hole. It's just silly to me. But more importantly, a endocrinologist told me about 8 years ago, the problem with insulin is that there is a very, very tight feedback loop for the pancreas. The pancreas doesn't just send out insulin in a stream, it pulses it. And it pulses it based on the feedback it's getting from the rest of the body. So there's this almost oscillatory value to it, let's say, traveling around the bloodstream. And when you take exogenous insulin, it's just a flat line, boom, it's there. And the reality is when we start to think about peptides, you know how we like to talk about minerals? They create the electrical system in the body, you know, the nerves, and they're like the wires, and the minerals, they create the reactions. Well, you can think of protein peptides the way we think of the radio frequencies that we use for radio and cellular. The length of the amino acid chain is like the frequency, and the pulse is like the transmit. So you hit the transmit button. And so these peptides, they have specific frequencies and amplitudes. And when you stop that, they don't work the way they're supposed to anymore. And that's part of the problem why, because the insulin doesn't give the pancreas a break when you start taking exogenous insulin. Because the body doesn't recognize that insulin and the pancreas thinks it still has to keep working anyway. So it's trying to work even though it's not putting anything out because that oscillatory, characteristic of the insulin is gone. So.
Correct. And actually the idea of giving people insulin is, it stems from treating a very different type of diabetes, which is type 1, where you simply
yes.
don't produce insulin.
Yeah.
I mean, in that case, you have a totally different situation, and that was the type that has been treated first, and for years, even decades, that was the type of diabetes we knew. Only today we have much fewer people who have or who suffer from type 1 than from type 2,
right.
And still the treatment is the same, even though the reasons are very different. I mean, sometimes you will have a situation where actually the pancreas in a type 2 diabetic is simply no longer able to produce insulin because it's defective. But for many people who, quite obviously you don't wake up and are type 2 diabetic, but you segue into that, and it takes years and years, until you get from being slightly insulin resistant to fully insulin resistant and to full blown, type 2 diabetes. And therefore, It really depends on where you are on the spectrum, whether it is total nonsense or it makes some sense to take insulin. I wouldn't say that it's always a bad idea to use insulin, but especially if you are still able to manage your blood glucose levels with other means, for example, with metformin or one of the newer drugs, the ones that are actually based on satiety peptides. Or quote unquote satiety peptides like GLP-1.
Yeah, like Victoza. Victoza is one of them. It's very, very popular right now. But the problem with Victoza,
I've read, I've written a study a couple of days ago where they have tested a new agonist of these of the receptors, and you have to take it only once a week, and it worked like a charm. So it's quite impressive that they are making that much progress here, and that will probably, if the study we've been talking about before is actually right. So if we assume that insulin blunts the natural ability of the body to heal in this domain in order to become insulin sensitive again, especially in the skeletal muscle, then those new drugs will be a huge chance for people who are willing to do both, to take the right drugs and obviously to change their lifestyle that has led to developing diabetes in the first place, to maybe get off all the drugs, assuming that there is no irreversible damage done already, which is possible, but it's also possible that it is not the case. So I'm quite curious if this study will actually lead to follow-up studies where they test, for example, the rate of remission in people on insulin therapy or high-dose therapy with other drugs that are able to manage the glucose levels. If the scientists are right, you should see a significant advantage for those people who are doing a lifestyle intervention who are not on insulin, even though they may be their glucose levels without any treatment would be similar to the ones with insulin. That would be a study that actually could confirm that this is the real problem here, that we are treating with insulin, and that makes all the lifestyle interventions maybe not useful, but at least significantly less effective.
Well, think about what you said earlier when you were talking about how this started out because of the treatment of type 1 diabetes, which is failure of the pancreas. And this is failure of the receptor. I mean, you could think of it as the pancreas is a transmitter, to stay with the RF, you know, theory of these protein peptides, and the receptor is the receiver. And so you have a bad transmitter, and you want to treat it by replacing the transmitter. But when you have a bad receiver, you don't treat it by replacing the transmitter.
Usually you shouldn't do it like that,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that was back in the day, that was the only thing people had
no,
in hand.
I know.
So it was a valid treatment option. But I think that especially with the advent of the new drugs, the peptide drugs that are being developed right now and are already available, insulin should really be only the option of choice if the others don't work any longer.
Right, I agree. All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, we're going to talk about non-nutritive sweeteners, because we've been debating non-nutritive sweeteners forever. Do they lead to obesity? Don't they lead to obesity? So there may be a mechanism here that Adele is going to talk about when we come back. Again, we're talking with Adele Moussa. This is Subversity Science Roundup. The website is Subversity, S-U-P-P. VERSITY.com. Stay tuned.
Crunchy? From the company that gave us the Quest protein bar, now comes the Quest high protein potato chips with 21 grams of high quality protein and only 5 grams of carbs and no artificial ingredients. Just like Quest bars, you'll feel like you're cheating, but you're not. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Quest high protein potato chip banner ad today and get ready to be satisfied. Thanks to Quest Nutrition, chips just aren't what they used to be.
4.6 million years of evolution gave us the blueprint for the perfect protein supplement for humans. So why do all protein supplement manufacturers ignore it? We don't. The first human-appropriate protein supplement is Thrive Advanced. Built around the blueprint of mother's milk, Thrive Advanced contains the amino acids, peptides, micronutrients, enzymes, probiotics, and vitamins that support protein absorption and assimilation. All of our dairy proteins come from happy cows on pastures here in the United States and are low-heat pasteurized. You'll never find any artificial sweeteners, additives, or ingredients. You won't even find thickeners or gums in Thrive Advanced. And we back up our label claims with post-production lab analysis that's available right on our website. Visit superhumanradio.com and click the Thrive Advance banner ad and use code SHR and save 50% off your entire order today.
Quest Keto is making the ketogenic lifestyle more delicious and more convenient than ever. The high-fat, moderate-protein, low-carb keto diet has earned a reputation for being complicated. Quest Keto has changed all of that by offering sweet and savory snacks and an entire line of ready-to-go ketogenic meals. They've taken the guesswork out of it for you. From keto cinnamon rolls, pizza, crackers, and more, you can enjoy it all and experience the benefits of this nutritious approach anytime, anywhere. Thanks to Quest Keto. Go to QuestKeto.com to order your meals today.
Eat dessert again with the new 100% natural line of high-protein, low-carb Quest Protein Bars. I love lemon cream pie and strawberry cheesecake, but you can choose from chocolate peanut butter, coconut cashew, or cinnamon roll as well. No matter which one you try, you'll feel like you're eating dessert. But this is no ordinary dessert. With 20 grams of high-quality whey protein isolate, 17 grams of prebiotic fiber, and sweetened with stevia, these bars will make you feel like you're cheating, but you're not. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Quest Protein Bar banner ad to learn more about these clean and delicious protein bars.
Do you know how to properly use carbohydrates to ignite your performance in the field and in the gym? You will now, thanks to this free book by EFX Sports. The Carb User's Guide for Maximum Performance reveals why omitting carbohydrates from your diet can totally crush your gains. Ever wonder how many grams you need for your specific sport? Not anymore. We give you the critical number you need to dominate your competition. You'll even discover the super carb that's taking the athletic world by storm. You must try it to believe it. Go to getcarbolin.com/carb guide today and get your copy absolutely free. Once again, it's getcarbolin.com/carbguide.
Individuals and businesses with tax problems, listen carefully. Do you feel like you're losing control over your finances? If you owe over $10,000 in back taxes or have unfiled tax returns, we can help you take back control. The IRS is the largest and most aggressive collection agency in the world, and they can seize your bank account, garnish your paycheck, close your business, and file criminal charges. Take control of your tax problems now by calling the experts at Tax Mediation Services and take advantage of the Fresh Start program and new laws that may allow us to negotiate a settlement for the lowest amount possible. Our team of tax attorneys and enrolled agents can stop collections and get you protected so you can take control of your financial future. Tax Mediation Services is accredited by the Better Business Bureau. Call now for a free case review and a price protection guaranteed quote.
Call Tax Mediation Services now at 800-616-0820. That's 800-616-0820. 800-616-0820.
The benefits of a ketogenic diet are immeasurable. Health, resist disease, mental function, and even performance. But getting into ketosis can take weeks, if even at all. Now you can get into ketosis in 10 minutes. KetoKana is the first ketone powder that has been clinically shown to switch you into a ketogenic state by providing a rush of ketones into the bloodstream. Like to train fasted or want to spare more muscle glycogen during workouts? Take a shot of KetoKana and hit it hard. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Keto Kana banner ad today.
This is the Superhuman Channel. Evolution just got kicked up a notch.
Welcome back. Adele, every now and then I get an email from somebody who says, hey, you know he says glycogen and not glycogen in that that Keto Kana ad. And I go, yeah. And people want to know why I leave it there. And you know why, Adele?
Maybe to make them remember.
They pay attention to it. They email. Look, if one person emails me, this is how it works in radio. Back in the old days, if someone sent you snail mail, one opinion equaled 1,000 other opinions. If they called you on the phone, one opinion equals about 100 other opinions. So I think that email is as convenient as a phone call, you know. A phone call. So that way I look at it like, okay, it's about 100 opinions. If I get one email from somebody who says, hey, he keeps saying, glycogen instead of glycogen, I'm like, oh yeah, 100 people are remembering that ad. Regardless of why they're remembering it, they're remembering it.
Yeah. Sometimes it's actually, even with television ads, the most stupid ones, they stick. So you remember them. And sometimes it's better to have a really bad advertisement on television for a company than having one that is good or okay, but you won't remember it.
Annoying. So let's talk about this. For a long time now, and you've even blogged about this before, people have always tried to say that non-nutritive sweeteners somehow lead to more obesity. People tried to debate, well, is it insulinogenic? Does it change the way the body prepares for the non-nutritive sweetener coming in? It thinks that glucose is coming in. But you've written about, you blogged about this, right? This the one we're talking about now?
That's actually just in the Facebook news on
Facebook. Okay, so this one's on Facebook.
On my Subversity Facebook page.
Okay.
But I've written about sweeteners extensively, and therefore I didn't want to address it once more. Because if you look at the experimental evidence, it is quite clear that all the hypotheses that relate to physiological responses to sweeteners, they couldn't be confirmed, at least not in human studies. And so there is no insulin response, for example, to sweetener intakes, at least especially not to the newer ones. There are some issues with the good old saccharine natrium, which appears to be, if you take it at relatively high amounts, appears to have at least some effect on insulin and other satiety hormones. But for all the other ones, there is no evidence that even in much higher amounts than you would find them in foods and or use them if you sweeten up your whey protein or do whatever with artificial sweeteners, in those amounts, they are really inert. They don't do anything to the acute response to a meal. But I've been telling people in all the articles in which I've been defending artificial sweeteners against these claims that they would make you hungry physiologically. I've been saying that you can run into a problem, though, because people who tend to use artificial sweeteners usually are the ones who actually like to eat sweet food.
Right.
And if you keep using those sweeteners, you will never be able to reduce your sweet tongue. I'm not quite sure if people who are listening have done that or have done what I have done back in the day many years ago when I, for several months, I didn't eat anything really that was sweet with sugar, and I didn't use any sweeteners either. And I remember how I felt that, or I suddenly started to feel that oatmeal was so sweet that
yes.
I could hardly tolerate it without adding any sugar to it. Because you really reset your palate, and suddenly things that have not been or haven't tasted sweet before any longer, they really taste sweet again. And if you are somebody who is really, I wouldn't say addicted, but who really likes his sweets and who also needs them for comfort purposes, and you always use sweeteners, and maybe you even increase the dosage, because for myself, I've noticed that when I still use them without thinking about it, I've been adding more and more sweeteners to, for example, my coffee in order to sweeten it. And you are really increasing your own tendency to like sweets and to crave sweets. And that is quite obviously, that increases your risk of overeating, especially on sweet foods. And you know that you can't always have the option that is sweetened only with artificial sweeteners. And even if it is, there are usually other ingredients in there from which you will get some calories.
Right.
So you will have an extra food intake. And I've been saying that before, but I didn't have a study to show that this is the case. And actually, there has just been done quite an interesting experiment where they took, I think, 21 young men and women, all normal weight. And what they wanted to see is how do those people respond to non-nutritive and sugar-sweetened beverages or meals in order to find out if you imagine you're going to a party, for example, you will usually have sweet snacks and savory snacks,
right.
Salty snacks.
Right.
And I'm not quite sure if people are like me, but I personally, once I've eaten a couple of bars of chocolate, I don't want another one. But I want some salty things, for
right.
example,
right.
some chips or some pretzels.
Right.
And when I've eaten some of those pretzels, I want to get back to the chocolate again. And that is in and out of itself a very interesting phenomenon. But as the scientists were able to show in this study, if you are drinking a non-nutritively sweetened beverage, or if you are consuming non-nutritively sweetened foods, then you will not have this effect of, oh, I have had enough sweet, but rather quite the opposite. So when they did this test, and with a computer test, you can try to find out how much people crave a certain food. And so they gave them the different test beverages, the one that is sugar sweetened and the one that was sweetened with an artificial sweetener, in this case sucralose. And every 30 minutes they did those tests, and they tried to find out what would the people, or how much do people now want a sweet snack or a salty snack. And what they found is quite intriguing, that after the sugary beverage, people really didn't want to have a sweet snack. What they wanted was, if they wanted it at all, they wanted a salty snack. But when they had the non-nutritively sweetened beverage, which was, interestingly enough, for the people just as satisfying and as tasty as the sugar-sweetened one, and they were asked half an hour and 1 hour and 2 hours and 4 hours later, when their appetite for sweet was tested, that increased. And this is something, if you see that on time scale within 4 hours already, you can expect that to be exponential, or this effect to be exponential greater, if you're always offering your body just the fake sweetness, and for weeks and months and years, then you will only increase your eagerness to actually get something that's really sweet. And that was exactly what I tried to describe in previous articles I've written, when I said, okay, I've shown you that there is no physiological response in terms of an insulin increase, for example, but there's still a good reason to at least use sweetness reasonably. And this is exactly the reason, because eventually you will end up craving sweets so much that you won't be able to resist. I mean, some of us will always be able to resist. We are so much in control of ourselves, but the tendency to gravitate towards sweets is going to increase, and that is probably due to the mismatch between what your body is telling, or what your body thinks is coming in, and what it will then really get from the beverage that is either sweetened with sugar or sweetened with an artificial sweetener, because the whole system is actually the whole system of nutrient intake and processing and judging how much we still need is very complicated.
Right.
And the mismatch between the signaling at the receptors that are tasting the sweetness and what later on ends up in your bloodstream in terms of glucose, that is something that will really mess with your body's and also your brain's ability to estimate what is really sweet. I remember I've been telling you about the experiment of not using any sweeteners and then tasting or thinking that oatmeal was very sweet. I also remember that when I in a phase where I've been using a lot of sweeteners, that regular chocolate wasn't really sweet for me, because I used so much sweetness in my protein powder, my chocolate protein powder, that I was used to much more sweetness.
Right.
And you are no longer really able to judge whether you are consuming, let's say, 30 grams of sugar from this beverage, or maybe 90 grams of sugar, because you can't distinguish between sweet and very sweet if you are always overdosing on those extremely sweet non-nutritive sweeteners.
And I can see why the body does that, as you pointed out. I wrote the word signaling here, and you said it. You know, so but when the signal, the glucose signaling kicks in, and the body doesn't see an in concert amount of a particular substrate that it associates with this signaling, it naturally goes, there's not as much in that. We have to turn up the sensitivity, or turn down the sensitivity, so that we consume more to get what we need. And it makes perfect sense. And it's really funny, because what other foods have that signaling capacity? Do you think, I understand, we're not talking about satiety here. We're actually talking about the mechanism.
No, that's quite interesting, because they asked the people, how satiated are you? How savory was it? How would you like to eat something more? So consciously, everything was the same with the two beverages. But still, there was this tendency, or this subconscious feeling of, I still need something sweet.
Uh-huh, yeah. That's interesting. You know, and it's funny, because glucose signaling is what causes cellular senescence. We did that show in 2007. And glucose signaling starts at the tongue. And there's a cascade of events that happen as soon as the tongue goes sugar. Because our bodies, from an evolutionary perspective, looked at sugar like it was platinum. It was the rarest thing. Like, you can get just plain old sugar, not have to chew the sap out of a tree for 8 hours a day. This was like, oh my God, this is gold. Get more of that. And the problem is that we still have that sensitivity and that recognition built into us about sugar.
Certainly, yes. And we have something similar for salt. I would suspect that you could do a similar study where you feed them pretzels initially, and then although there is no salt replacement, well, you could maybe use
potassium.
Potassium.
Yeah,
salt.
Potassium.
But I'm not quite sure. I think that study hasn't been done, but it is possible that this would work similarly, because you don't get what you may be expecting. Although, if you have tried potassium salt already, you will know it doesn't really taste equal to regular salt. So I think that this study would fail because of that. But in general, you're absolutely right. So there is some one way or another where that guides us to eat certain foods. I mean, you will probably know that some people say that for salt, this is quite clear. For example, if you have had a workout where you've been sweating profusely, then you will obviously be on the lookout for salty foods afterwards. And I've tried to get to the bottom of that, but unfortunately there's no good research. But there's some evidence from, do you know what pica is, when people eat actually dirt?
Oh, yeah, we've talked about it, that geophagy. It's actually good for you to some degree, because the minerals and there's other things in it. There's even microbes in
it.
Yeah,
and there's good research actually that shows that those people who do that, they eat all the more dirt, the more they need the minerals that are in the dirt. And they wouldn't eat the dirt if they don't eat the minerals. And we don't have the corresponding research for foods in general. But sometimes I think that it would be interesting to see whether, for example, if you have a zinc deficiency, are you going to gravitate towards foods that are really high in zinc,
right,
or things like that? And I'm not quite sure, but I would guess that maybe not to the same extent as this is the case for sugar, because we can initially taste, even before we swallowed, we can taste this is sweet.
Right.
We can't taste whether there's zinc in it. But I would think that maybe something like if you a learned response, so to say, would
well. What about what you don't think that there's a high sensitivity olfactory function going on? I mean, we talk about how women can smell, like when they kiss a man, they can tell that this man has certain things that they don't, that would contribute to good offspring. We talked about that; it's scientifically been shown. So, don't you think we may have some that hasn't been mapped? Because all they care about is the things that sell food and perfume. But don't you think there's a high sensitivity olfactory component to that?
I guess there is. Although it is always questionable how sensitive this still is in our days and age, where our foods and the things around us are no longer pristine, in to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
The same thing that happens with the sweetness will, for example, happen if you have all these other artificial food components that make the cheap vegetable fats taste like cheese and smell like cheese.
Yes.
When you have these fake cheese that is not even made out of dairy.
Right. Right.
And quite interestingly enough, now they are selling this for with a price tag that's higher than regular cheese because it's a vegan.
Right. And
in this day and age, you really have to look at the label and find foods where you only have a few. The fewer items you have on the label, the better you are. And I would assume that if you are eating those foods with the least ingredients that will make it more difficult for your body to identify what's actually in them. Just like artificial sweetness, for example, tell your body there's sugar in it, but there is no sugar in it.
Right.
Things like artificial vanilla aroma, will tell your body there's vanilla in it, although there quite obviously is no vanilla in it. And the fewer of the those foods we will be consuming, I think the better we will get again at knowing what we need at this very moment and what we don't need.
You're absolutely right. We take for granted when we fool our body and make something taste different, and we say, oh, well, this has no fat in it. Oh, it tastes like it has fat in it. We take for granted that the body gets confused. Because the body prepares when it tastes things in it, in the mouth. It prepares the systems. It gets ready for, oh man, look what we got coming. Let's get ready. And we just think, that's no big deal. Oh, that's no big deal. We'll just fool the body. And we're fooling ourselves.
And quite interestingly, it is, from the study, it's also quite obvious that people are have different levels of susceptibility to that. Not necessarily when it comes to the reaction of, oh, now I want something sweet, but rather when it comes to whether they react or act on that or not. Because if you look at the actual data in terms of what the people later ate, then there is not that much of a group difference, not even a statistically significant difference. When they put sweets on the table, and they said you can eat as much as you want, and the ones who previously had the non-nutritive sweetener, the artificial sweetener, and in whom they detected a tendency to gravitate towards sweets now, they ate more on average, but not significantly more. But if you look at the actual data for the individuals, there are five people who ate more than double the amount than the others. And this also goes to tell you that maybe some people who are now listening are laughing and say, well, that's not a problem for me. And it can't be that this is not a problem for them. But for others, it may be a really significant problem. When I posted that on Facebook as a news item on Facebook on the Subversity page, somebody responded that he was drinking Diet Coke all day and he was craving sweets all day. So this person clearly is susceptible to this problem, while somebody else may not.
Right. You know what? I just had a thought. So we clearly see that when there is a disparity between the intended effects of the signaling and the actual nutritive value of the food that the body's expecting, there becomes this kind of dissynchronization and things happen that are not good. Let's talk about fat and protein just for a second. Let's just postulate for a second that the same thing happens with fat and protein. So when they make these foods that are fat-free, but the tongue feel is there, the body expects fat. What if it does something bad with the fat as opposed to good with the fat, number one? But here's the thing I just thought of. What if you ate one day of vegan incomplete protein a week? I wonder if that would have an effect on upregulating the total protein synthetic response when you eat a whole protein like dairy or meat or eggs the following day, because the body thinks we have protein coming. We know what to do. But then when the protein comes in, because it's incomplete, it's like you're missing whole words. You can't really read the book. And the body goes, wow, this protein's not doing what we expect it to do. So we have to turn the metabolic machinery up because we're not able to extract what we need out of this protein. Then the next day you actually give it whole proteins.
Well, that would suggest that you also have exaggerated insulin response to sugar if you've been consuming artificial sweeteners before, and that's not the case.
Yeah, okay.
So
okay.
I'm quite sure it is possible that this works, so I can see that some bodybuilders who are listening are going to try that tomorrow. So they are going to have vegan protein day tomorrow in order to grow double the day after. But I'm not quite sure. What is also something I would like to see a study to investigate, actually, and your idea reminded me of that, is whether you have something like a habituation effect to threshold leucine or protein intake. So, for example, if you is it really a good idea to consume, let's say, 20 grams of high-quality protein every 2 hours? In order to spike the mTOR response once again and once again and once again, or is that going to give some sort of saturation effect or even produce something like leucine resistance, like you see it for sugar and insulin? So that is something, a study that I would be really curious to see. So if that is a problem, because there is an interesting older rodent study I've written about years ago, which shows that this appears to be the case for the protein synthetic response that is triggered by exercise. So with the first workout, so to say, it is really high. And if you continue to do the same thing again, and they did the same thing again in the rodents, it really became less and less, and the bonus you got from each of the workouts decreased. And then they had 2 weeks of rest for these rodents, and afterwards it was back to normal. So I would expect that something like that, which is quite obviously a different area of research, but something like that could happen for protein as well. And when it comes to fats, for example, and the replacements you have quite often in those foods, you often end up actually consuming at least as much calories. One of my favorite examples is the yogurt. If you buy a fruit yogurt, it's already full of sugar. But if you buy a fruit yogurt that is fat reduced, you will have so much more sugar in it that usually, even though sugar has only 4 calories and fat has 9 calories, the low-fat variety has so much sugar in it to compensate for the lack of taste effect of the fat that it has the same energy value, or sometimes even more if you take a look at the labels.
Interesting.
So this whole idea of replacing is, in some cases it really makes sense. But in many cases, we introduce substances into the foods in order to be able to draw away, for example, the fat and still keep this savory mouthfeel, of which we really don't know whether they are as safe as the initial studies we have would suggest.
Last thing I'm going to interject, not to beat a dead horse, but Leo Costa came on this show recently. The first time he was on my show was in 2006 when he came on to talk about the book Big Beyond Belief. And he talked about back then that the Bulgarian coaches used to have the Bulgarian weightlifters do protein fasts, 1 to 2 days without any protein, because they said that this stimulated a greater protein synthetic response when they started to add protein back into their diet. Any thoughts on that? Because
yeah,
of what we're talking
that's
about.
That's what I said. I would expect that this makes. Oh, I would expect.
But
that
wouldn't the eating an incomplete protein have the same response?
I'm not quite sure because the incomplete protein is not completely incomplete, so to say.
Okay.
Maybe it may lack leucine and a few other essential amino acids. But for example, I think maybe 5 or 6 days ago, I posted a study that once more confirmed that citrulline, for example, which is clearly not an essential amino acid, it's a derivative of arginine, that it is able to actually trigger mTOR as well. And if you take a look at the anti-aging research, even though anti-aging researchers say that mTOR is the problem, they are not looking only at leucine. They are also looking at methionine, for example,
right,
which appears to be a problem in terms of its effect on this aging component of mTOR and the whole anabolism window. So in essence, the idea of having no protein at all appears to be the safer option, and it's also the option that has only recently been confirmed to actually have a very significant effect on the immune system. You will remember that there was this one study that showed that I think 2 or 3 days of fasting, 48 hours or so, is something like an immune system reset.
Right.
And the scientists believe, although in this case that was a complete fast, most scientists believe that this is mostly due to the lack of protein in the diet.
Mm-hmm.
It's also different for what it is already good if you fast, like intermittent fasting, have a 16-hour window, because that has far-reaching metabolic effects, which are beneficial for you. And actually that comes back to what we've been talking about before in relation to the study that shows that giving diabetics insulin is not good for them, because those processes that insulin blunts and the type 2 diabetics, those are the same processes that are initiated when you fast intermittently.
Right.
Those metabolic processes are emphasized if you don't eat foods for 16 hours, which is relatively easy if you your last meal is not too late and you either have a late breakfast or skip breakfast altogether, then this is going to have significant metabolic effects. But the latest research appears to suggest that it takes a bit more fasting or a bit longer time of fasting in order to have these effects on the immune system. And this is something the lifters, the Bulgarian lifters, could also have benefited from,
right?
Because we all know that the immune system is significantly involved in the repair process and also in the restructuring processes that are taking place in the musculature, which will then make your muscles grow and make them stronger as well. So the whole idea that you will have to eat 24/7 in order to be able to perform at a maximum level and in order to grow, that has been reversed by science lately.
Yes.
It is not really possible to lose muscle in terms of all the cells while you are fasting. You may lose the glycogen, for example, and you may even lose some of the protein that's in there. But the idea that you introduced a few minutes ago, that you benefit afterwards because there is a significant increase in the amount of protein synthesis, also tells you that that the little loss you may have in the 2 or 3 days of eating little protein will be compensated and even super compensated in
right.
the days afterwards.
Right. I want to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, we're going to talk about a problem that a lot of people suffer from today, and that is SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And I have a theory that more people have a version of SIBO that maybe isn't sending them to the doctors, but it's causing lots of little problems that they just kind of ignore and chalk up to, my gut is not the best. We're going to talk about this when we come back from the break. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Subversity Science Roundup.
How to properly use carbohydrates to ignite your performance in the field and in the gym? You will now, thanks to this free book by EFX Sports. The Carb User's Guide for Maximum Performance reveals why omitting carbohydrates from your diet can totally crush your gains. Ever wonder how many grams you need for your specific sport? Not anymore. We give you the critical number you need to dominate your competition. You'll even discover the super carb that's taking the athletic world by storm. You must try it to believe it. Go to getcarbolin.com/carb guide today and get your copy absolutely free. Once again, it's getcarbolin.com/carbguide.
Anabolicminds.com is the premier website for credible information on building muscle, burning fat, supplementation, and more. With over 100,000 active registered members and over 2.5 million posts, it's one of the largest communities on the internet to get help and answers to your questions. It's also the place that the official Superhuman Radio Forum is hosted. Visit AnabolicMinds.com today and get into the action. AnabolicMinds.com. Learn. Teach. Lead.
New Mass Pro Synthogen X2 just upped its own legendary game. To distance itself even further from the rest of the pack, Synthogen X2 now has double the key active ingredients. If you've ever wondered what steroid-like recovery feels like, Synthogen X2 delivers. See why others compare it favorably to powerful bodybuilding drugs at Synthogen.com. Mass Pro Synthogen. When you train with it, you'll gain with it.
Hey, this is Carl. Start your day just like I do with a high-dose lipospheric vitamin C from Livon Labs. You too can benefit from Livon Labs' lipospheric delivery system. No more pills or powders. That's outdated technology. Livon Labs has the world's most efficient vitamin delivery system, period. Learn a lot more today at livonlabs.com and benefit from their new reduced pricing. That's livonlabs.com, livonlabs.com.
Few products can boast being considered the food of the gods by the Aztecs, but the ingredients in Bio Superfood have been. Some algae are the most efficient forms of nutrients, proteins, minerals, enzymes, fatty acids, antioxidants, and much more. Bio Superfood is something you have to experience for yourself. That's why, for a limited time, buy any Bio Superfood products and save 15% off your first order.
Go to superhumanradio.com and click the banner ad to read the research and learn why BioSuperfood is the best supplement in the world you're not already taking.
Hey, this is Carl. I want to remind you of the importance of electrolytes because of all the workout supplements on the market today, I think electrolytes are the most important but the most overlooked. Check out the new Jigsaw Electrolyte Supreme. It contains a broad spectrum of electrolytes plus a few extra minerals and vitamins. The lemon-lime flavor tastes great, and it comes in single-serving packets that make it easy for you to take on the go. Visit superhumanradio.com and click the Jigsaw Electrolyte Supreme banner ad today and save 10% off your purchase.
Alaskans agree that sockeye offers the truest salmon taste. Over decades of fishing Alaskan waters, Vital Choice has rare access to the very finest of these fish. Vital Choice sockeye comes from smaller harvest regions with fewer boats and faster processing. So our sockeye is flash frozen within hours of harvest to capture its fresh caught quality. Rich in flavor, omega-3s, and vitamin D, our most popular salmon also abounds in astaxanthin, the potent antioxidant that provides its vibrant red hue. Save 15% off. Go to Superhuman Radio and click the Vital Choice banner ad today.
This is the Superhuman Channel, doing reps with the weight of the world.
Welcome back. I've had a lot of people email me who took me up on the challenge. I said, hey, stop taking fish oil capsules that you're going to burp up for 6 hours afterwards, and you don't even know if they're rancid, and start eating more salmon. The best salmon in the world can be flown right to your door thanks to Vital Choice. This is fresh, flash frozen on the boat right after they catch it. Sockeye salmon from Alaska. Eat a few pieces of salmon every single week and forget about taking those fish oil capsules. I'm telling you. And by the way, I got two emails from people saying they found out that they had grass-fed beef there. They do. They have a Kobe grass-fed beef at Vital Choice. You won't find that anywhere else. So check them out and stop taking fish oil and burping up fish oil. Okay. The next discussion is equally important, and I kind of gave a little preview of what we're going to be talking about. SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. For people who don't even know what this is, explain it.
Well, basically, the name gives it away already. So you in your small intestine, you already have bacteria. But the number of bacteria and the makeup is relatively is different from the one you have in your colon in the later parts of the colon. So if you take a look at the numbers, you have at the numbers of the bacteria that you should find there, then there are 10 to 100,000 more. 10 to 100,000 times more bacteria in the later parts of your digestive tract,
right.
And 1 million to 10 million or even 100 million more bacteria in your colon. So the number of bacteria in this first part, so to say, of your digestive tract after the stomach, it should be very limited. And the type of bacteria is also usually much different from the ones you would find in your colon. If you suffer from SIBO, then you have, first of all, there are way too many bacteria in this part of your digestive tract. And quite often there are also bacteria in there that produce either substances that are toxic, so to say, for your body, or they trigger an antigen response within your small intestine, so that it's kind of like an allergy trigger that is within you all the time, and this in turn can obviously trigger inflammation, which can then lead, for example, to structural disintegration of the wall of the small intestine, which will then allow the toxins, the other bacteria produced, to leak into the system, etc., 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 and you are in a vicious cycle that has all sorts of consequences which are not yet fully researched, but can range from the quite obvious symptoms like gastrointestinal distress, to things like brain fog and other symptoms that you would not usually relate to intestinal problems.
But I've read that diseases like Parkinson's disease have been associated with really bad cases of SIBO. We're talking about.
There's good research that shows that Parkinson's patients are much more likely to have a small intestinal bacteria overgrowth than people who are not suffering from Parkinson's. But that we have to be very careful about that, because those are the same studies, is the same type of study that will also tell you that drinking artificial sweetened beverages is mechanistically making you fat. That could be a correlation. So, for example, if you take a look at your risk or at the risk of developing SIBO, then all sorts of other metabolic diseases will significantly increase your risk. So it could be rather that some sort of metabolic disease increases both the risk of SIBO and Parkinson's. So there's no clear-cut evidence, but this doesn't exclude either that there is a causative part in here as well, or maybe simply something like SIBO is part of the vicious circle in which will then later on trigger Parkinson's and other diseases like that. Because usually there is no, or at least by now, we don't have a single trigger for a complex illness like that. It's not like we have identified a virus or a bacteria, one that would trigger that.
So but
you're right, there are links to Parkinson's and other
heart disease, stiffening of arteries, people who develop roseola, which is a rosacea, which is the redness of the face, and even lumps of the face have been associated with SIBO. Actually, the skin sometimes in some people is the earliest warning sign of SIBO, next to bloating after just about any kind of meal with fiber in it, especially. You know, you just get gassy. That, you know, the fermentation process usually happens down further in the digestive system. But when you have SIBO, some of those fibers are used up front. And so instead of them going down south and coming out the back end of it, they go back up into your stomach and they come out your throat. And so if you're somebody who has red skin on your face, red on your chest, you notice that, gee, you know, I have this redness all the time. I don't know where it's coming from. Or meals high in fiber or even some carbohydrate sources tend to just bloat you. They feel like they don't move and all you do is belch and belch and belch. You need to think about, and it may not be to the extent of what we call SIBO, but you need to think about the colonization of your small intestine, which, by the way, is actually the large intestine in my mind, because it's a huge, big old sausage of a thing, as opposed to the skinny one down south. But I have a strange feeling, just like we've learned frank diabetes is dangerous, but even pre-diabetes is dangerous. The diseases just happen slower. I have this suspicion that a lot of people have a version of SIBO, just a hypercolonization.
I would think the same. And actually, that already can be a problem, because SIBO will also make it more difficult for you to properly absorb fat-soluble vitamins like A, D, E, and especially vitamin K. And
overproduce some B vitamins. You could actually end up with folate poisoning from some version of SIBO. Yeah.
I also learned that only recently, because basically the reason we are talking about that is that there's been a new review which actually compared or tried to investigate whether it makes sense to use probiotics in order to get rid of the bacteria in your gut. I mean, it is quite counterintuitive at first to say, well, you have to take new bacteria in order to get rid of the abundance of bacteria you don't want to have in your small intestine. But the interesting thing is that this particular review found that there's relatively convincing evidence that large amounts of beneficial bacteria and of various strains actually help with reducing the symptoms, especially the symptoms, but also the rather accurately tested degree of SIBO or of colonization of the upper intestinal of the small intestines by bacteria you don't want there, this is something you could achieve with products that are readily available on the market
and small doses. These were relatively small doses, 2 billion CFUs of one every three times a day. That's a low dose.
Yeah, exactly. So that is actually what I found quite surprising. One thing we have to keep in mind, though, and that is a problem I actually realized only when I was trying to get at the bottom of the reasons or of triggers of SIBO. I've been looking at proton pump inhibitors, which are often called the main or one of the main reasons people are developing SIBO, because usually you would have the very acidic chyme in the stomach, it would leak into the upper intestine, and then the bacteria don't thrive in a milieu like that. And so people have always been speculating that that reducing the stomach acid with proton pump inhibitors would actually predispose you to develop SIBO. And when I've been trying to find evidence for that, I was quite surprised that the studies there are about as many studies that say, well, there is no correlation as there are studies that say there is an increased risk. And there's one very interesting review that has been done 4 years ago, and that is really educative in the sense as it is the only one, at least I read, which distinguished between studies which used this regular breath test in order to diagnose SIBO,
right,
and tests where you actually get a probe from the colon, or rather from the small intestine, in order to see what kind of bacteria you have there. And if you take a look, or if the scientists took a look only at the studies that used one of those much more sensitive tests, the result was quite different. There was one study actually that said that people who are taking PPIs are 38% more likely to develop SIBO. On average, it was only, quote unquote, only a 7- to 8-fold increase. But that made me think about the results of the reviews the results of the more recent review, of which I've just been telling you that it says that taking probiotics is very effective on its own, even without an antibiotic,
right,
to reduce the symptoms. Because in those studies, in all of them I've taken a look at later on, the ones that have been reviewed, all of them use one of those breath tests, which are not 100% accurate. But still, if the result is now a negative, and it was positive before, we can at least tell for sure that, if I come back to what you said before, that on the scale of minimal SIBO to maximal SIBO, you have made large strides towards minimal SIBO,
right,
if you haven't gotten rid of the syndrome completely. So there's no doubt that this works with the probiotics, but I wouldn't say that it is necessarily proven that you can eradicate the bacteria completely. And actually, that's not what you want. You want some bacteria remaining there, but you want to reduce the total amount or total number of bacteria significantly.
Okay, so the next logical question, to kind of weave in things we've spoken about already today, where does fasting fit in trying to work with SIBO? Any ideas?
Well, why I haven't seen studies on that. It is quite logical, as you said before. If you're feeding the bacteria there, they are going to thrive.
Flourish,
so
right.
If you're fasting, and especially if you are fasting and have a normal or regular stomach acid production, then some of these acidic chyme when you swallow is going to go down there, and it's very likely that you will be able to reduce the count of bacteria, because they can't live without food, so to say, and their food is, depending on the type of bacteria, quite obviously, is what you eat. And if you don't eat anything, then the number of bacteria is certainly going to reduce to be reduced as well.
Okay, so and my next question was, what if you added some acidic component to fasting? Because I had a feeling you know we're talking about the acidity actually perhaps being protective. What if you started using apple cider vinegar during a fast if your goal was to try to normalize the colonization of your small intestine?
Well, I guess that people usually overestimate the acidity of apple cider vinegar if you compare it to the acidity of your stomach acid. So I'm not sure it can have a beneficial effect, but in general, it is not, apple cider vinegar is not acidic compared to
the stomach. Okay, how about betaine hydrochloride then? Since
that could certainly have an effect, because it is basically forming stomach acid when it arrives in your stomach. So I would think that it has an effect, but that is mere guesswork. So
right.
I haven't seen a study confirming that. But that is certainly something, and there are also some essential oils that appear to be working for that. So
do you know which ones they are? Which ones?
There's one which is particularly prominent or is often cited in order to be successful in doing that. I will briefly have to check that. I think I've saved it somewhere here. Just a second. Let me see.
I think a lot of people, I'm going to just talk while you're doing that. We call this vamping in radio. I'm going to vamp a little bit. I really think there's a lot of people out there who suffer from a very, very low grade version of overcolonization of the small intestine. And they just live with it. They burp a lot. Certain foods bloat them, so they avoid those foods. And I really feel strongly that there's a lot of people who have redness in their face, redness on their chest, and they just kind of go, oh, you know, I don't know what that is, but it's not hurting me. I'm just going to go on with it. Especially if you have advanced roseola, where you get that blotchy red stuff that almost looks scaly sometimes on your face. You need to start thinking about SIBO. This is some of the earliest telltale signs, as well as constipation. The people who tend to be constipated with no rhyme or reason, think about SIBO. And it's relatively easy to eradicate or actually get under control in as little as 6 weeks if you do the right things. I really feel strongly about fasting, adding some acidity to your gut. Because interestingly enough, a lot of these microbes, as well as fungi, that seem to be part of the SIBO matrix, actually, to protect themselves, shut down the production of acidity in the stomach to protect themselves. And so they downregulate the acidity of your stomach to make their environment nicer.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually what is quite interesting also is that people who are suffering from indigestion, they are much more likely to get these problems, because regularity will also regularly clean all the colon, and including the small intestine, up. So if you are not regular, and then it is much more likely that the wrong bacteria will proliferate in your small intestine, and you are going to have a problem. And also people who have PPI or who are using PPIs, which is something that reminds me of the situation with artificial sweetness, because obese people often use artificial sweetness in their effort to lose weight. So if you look at epidemiological data, you will find that people who use artificial sweetness usually weigh more than other people. And the same could be the case for PPIs, because one of the symptoms you can have if you have a SIBO is actually that you have an acid reflux, because it really doesn't go through. It doesn't. The stomach cannot empty effectively because of the mess in your small intestine. And then you are taking PPIs and actually making things only worse, which takes me back to the oils, because I've found them back. So the one that is mentioned most often is actually oregano oil.
Yeah.
And also lemon balm oil. What is quite interesting is that on the list is also one of the recent heroes in the supplement field, which is berberine. So berberine appears to be also able to actually control the amount of bacteria in the small intestine. So those are natural options that can help. Even though if you are really suffering from severe symptoms of SIBO, I think that there is no way to get around antibiotic treatment yet. Which is, and that is quite important to remember, which has been shown to be much more effective if it's combined with probiotics. Because if you throw in the good bacteria while you are eradicating the others, and especially afterwards in high doses, you can make sure that you are not going to get the same gut inhabitants you don't want to have.
I've actually talked about this. Whenever we've done shows about the microbiome, I've always asked whoever I've had on the show. So if I, you know, when your lawn gets loaded with weeds, you kill the entire lawn and you reseed. And I said, can we do that with our guts? And you can, with the right type of antibiotics. And then immediately you've got to really pound down high amounts of these microbes and prebiotics as well.
Yeah, exactly. And there's really good research that this doubles the efficiency of the antibiotic treatment. So if you do it without probiotics, you will end up with usually the same symptoms and
coming
the same
back.
Problems again, or often you will end up with the same problems again. And you have taken the risk of side effects for nothing. So it's really important that you have a good probiotic already when you do that with the antibiotics. And for people who are interested in actually which products that were used in the different studies, I've listed them in the article, which is on my website. So, and it's not like there's only one type of bacteria that can help. It's quite interesting that there are several types, and also the usual suspects like lactobacilli and the others you will find in the regular probiotics you may be buying in the shop next door, so to say. So it doesn't necessarily have to be extremely fancy.
You know, the antibiotic that is most successful when treating SIBO is something called neomycin. It goes by the name of rifaximin. And so,
And
they can test you if you have SIBO through a breath test. Because like I said, since stuff is being digested in a way that's normally digested further down and even into the colon, up by the gut, you burp that stuff up. And so they can actually do breath tests for you. And with a great deal of efficiency, very, very efficient to figure it out. It's high hydrogen, that a lot of hydrogen comes out. And hydrogen has no smell, by the way.
Yeah, you have to drink this lactulose drink, and then you can detect the hydrogen. Unfortunately, the sensitivity of the test is only 6 to 68%. So this is really, if this test is successful and says you have SIBO, you are pretty likely going to have a severe form of SIBO already. Because you have so many bacteria that are producing hydrogen. If it's not that much of a problem, you are likely not to, or the doctor is likely to find no results with the test. That's really one of the main problems. We don't have a 100% reliable test for SIBO yet. So sometimes it's like trying to test for diabetes with a glucometer that doesn't really work.
Right.
Or that will only show that you are insulin resistant if your glucose levels are already two times the normal one.
Right.
And you are almost sugar-coated from inside. So it's really necessary to have a better test. And that's one of the cases where people underestimate the problems of a health issue, and therefore there are neither medications nor tests nor anything else. Because quite obviously everybody knows that having high blood sugar levels is a real problem, but most people probably don't even know what SIBO is. And many doctors will also tell you, well, okay, now you're burping, who cares?
Yeah.
that the long-term effects and consequences could be really severe is something that is only surfacing very slowly. And you can also see that if you type that in PubMed, for example, the number of studies that have been done is relatively low. It's a bit similar. It's not yet similar, but maybe it's going to be similar to vitamin D. I mean, if you 15 years ago, if you typed in vitamin D in PubMed, I don't know. Well, 15 years ago, it was already there, yes.
Yeah, but you wouldn't have found
a lot
of research.
Only a few results.
Yeah, yeah.
These days, you have 15 studies per week trying to investigate the effects of vitamin D on this and that. And everybody thought about vitamin D as only something that is relevant for bones. And with the newfound focus on the importance of the microbiome, the one in our gut and also in other places, we've been talking about the one in our mouth, which is going to turn relatively inert mercury into organic mercury that can then pass the blood-brain barrier. With all these efforts in trying to find out how these microbes are actually affecting us, I would suggest, or I would suspect, that in a few years, probably SIBO is something more and more researchers are paying attention to.
I take VSL number 3, but it comes in a variety of different forms. I buy packets that have 450 billion CFUs of 8 different non-overlapping probiotic forms. And it's very expensive. I pay $82 a month, and Elisa.
Yeah,
and I
somebody
take,
said on Facebook that's cheap.
I did
for this particular product.
I did. Yeah, it's actually usually about $125, and so and that's 450 billion CFUs in a pouch, you know, that you're throwing down there. So it's very high. So the potential for colonization is there. This is all great information.
Yeah, it actually was one of the products that has been tested in one of the studies. I think that one of the reasons the price is so high is that this is one of the few companies that's actually doing research on their products.
They've been approved. There are a couple of good studies out
there testing this particular product. Also, one that is quite interesting where they overfed young men on a diet, I think, with extra 1,000 or 1,500 calories. I'm not quite sure. Also a high-fat diet, so high-fat as the science interpretation of high-fat, meaning that it was high in fat and carbohydrates, so basically high in energy. And what they found is that when the subjects consumed this probiotic product during this intervention, they gained significantly less body fat. And quite obviously, you have to be skeptical about any sponsored research, but this is in line with non-sponsored research with other, usually lower-dose products, especially in rodents. So this whole area of research in terms of the gut microbiome is really exciting, although you have to be careful. I wouldn't expect that in 10 years from now you will have a probiotic to cure every disease. That is unrealistic. But to pay no attention to it is just as wrong as to silly. Really overestimate the effect you may see from a product like that.
You know, the VSL number 3 and all the probiotics that were used in this research are on Adele's website, Supversity, SUPPVERSITY.com. It's interesting, like the VSL, they only used 110 billion CFUs of VSL to get the results they were looking for in 6 weeks. So the idea of taking a pouch every day, which is roughly four times that.
Maybe too much, yeah.
I know. It may actually be too much. So
and we don't know. It's really possible that too much is bad as well. Because one of the reasons I think that we really have a lot to learn in this area of research is we usually say those are the bad guys and those are the good guys. But eventually, those bad guys may only be the bad guys because their ratio to the other guys is not correct. So if you have too much of too many of the good guys, for example, the lactobacilli, of which we usually, when people hear lactobacillus, they say, whoa, that's one of the good guys. I want more of them. But eventually, you may end up running into trouble as well if there are too many of those. And another species, which is also important for the balance, is no longer there. I mean, we see that in nature everywhere that, for example, a rainforest can only exist if the bad guys are there as well. If you only have the other animals and no predators any longer, then the whole system will collapse. And it may be very similar for the ecosystem within ourselves, where we really don't have a clear-cut idea of how it works. And one thing that makes this very, very difficult to investigate, actually, is that you can't, for example, say that I look at the lean person A and see that the lean person A has more of these and that bacteria, and the obese person B has more of these and that bacteria. Because when you put the obese person B on the same diet as the lean person A and wait until it is as lean as a person A, then its microbiome will be the same as
right,
the one
it changes.
From person A.
Yeah.
So this is really complicated. I remember that I think 2 years ago there was a study from Israel that hit the media really. You really had it on even on the regular television news, at least here in Germany, where they said that scientists had finally identified that if you have this and that microbiome, then you will always be lean. And then they realized in a follow-up study that when they fed the subjects all the same foods, they developed
the same microbiome.
The microbiome became identical, and
right.
And that was more a function of what the people ate and than of the microbiome itself. So it's really difficult to say what are the main triggers, and it's also really difficult to say how much influence we have when we throw in exogenous probiotics. I think if you stick to the same diet that gave you the quote-unquote bad microbiome, it's really not going to be fixed by throwing in more of the right bacteria.
Right.
Similar to the idea of, well, I'm eating only crap all day, but I'm taking a high-dose multivitamin, so now I'm super healthy.
Look at this. The name of the disorder is about intestinal bacteria overgrowth. It doesn't say dysbiosis. It says, the idea is that this small intestine is supposed to have a small amount of early, bacteria that gets things ready for the downstream processing. And when you have too much bacteria in there, it starts digesting there instead of downstream.
Yep.
So the idea of eradicating overgrowth by just overgrowing other bacteria in its place, that's not going to solve the problem either. That's probably why, but that's probably why a combination of antibiotic and probiotic works better than carpet bombing with good probiotics, because then you just have overgrowth of a different type of bug in there. That's it.
Yeah, the idea probably is that this type of bacteria that you have in those probiotics you use for this purpose, they don't thrive in the small intestine. They thrive further down in the colon.
Ah, so they're suicide. They're suicide. They commit suicide. They take the place of the other one and then they die off.
Yeah, more or less that's the idea. Although that is also part of ongoing research. As I said, the microbiome is really hot these days, so people are doing a lot of research in this area, and especially if you read the press releases, it sounds as if you could cure everything in the future by modifying the microbiome. But in reality, we are only scratching at the surface in terms of our understanding of this ultra-complex system. I mean, there are more different bacteria in our guts than cells in our body. So you can assume how difficult it is to understand this system.
Yeah, it's like you want to treat foot pain by treating the footprint in the sand. The microbiome may just be the fingerprint of what you're doing nutritionally, and not necessarily be the more corollary than causative of a lot of these diseases.
Nutritionally, there's good research showing that exercise modifies the microbiome as well.
Hormones do too. We know that oxytocin favors L-reuteri. We know that when oxytocin drops, the L-reuteri, which is considered one of the interesting bugs right now for anti-aging purposes, when oxytocin drops, L-reuteri dies off.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. I think melatonin has also a certain link to.
Didn't you write a blog post about that? That melatonin actually changes the diversity of the microbes, right?
Yeah, and that scientists speculate that this is part of its anti-aging effect, exactly.
But
and
wait a minute, so think about this, right? So that's melatonin that's endogenous. When we take melatonin orally and drop it in our stomach, the effects have to be tenfold greater because it's originating right there and dispersing through the body from there.
Yeah, and the question is that good or bad?
Right.
In a high dosage. Although you remember the study that has recently been published where they gave the people 100 milligrams of melatonin per day, or what was the dosage?
Yeah, 100 milligrams a day.
And had them exercise?
Yeah, but they weren't looking at their microbes. They weren't going, hey, these microbes change. You see, there's a study I read probably back in 2008 that showed that a high-dose oral melatonin changed the gut also produces some thyroid hormone. I could be a little bit off on this. It's been a long time since I read the study, but the gut produces either some thyroid hormone or a hormone that interacts with thyroid hormone, and that taking oral melatonin blunts the production of that hormone. It also affects the production of cholecystokinin, not necessarily positive or negative, but it's clear that when you take oral melatonin, that 3 milligrams is a lot of melatonin. People don't realize that's a lot of melatonin, a lot more than even the youthful pineal gland pulses, and you disperse it from there where it's not designed to be sequestered and originate, you change things in that area.
Yeah, of course. Of course. That's the same with every hormone.
Yeah.
And actually, from the most inert nutrient we eat, everything has certain downstream effects. And I think if you would think about all of them, you would go crazy. But especially with things that are so powerful as melatonin, you better err on the lower side.
Yeah.
I would argue.
I'm getting.
Although there's relatively good safety data for the regular amounts people take, like 1 to 3 milligrams and even 10 milligrams. There's very little data, especially on long-term use for higher dosages.
Right.
And I mean, even the idea that supplement companies are offering dosages of 100 milligrams per pill appears to be quite, I have to say it appears to be, it is very confusing for me, because there's really no application I can think of where you would really need 100 milligrams. Unless you think that you want to use it as a systemic antioxidant, but that is certainly not the purpose and could have side effects in the long term that nobody can predict. So rather err on the side of caution. And I mean, in the U.S., it's quite interesting that you can buy it over the counter, because here it's a regulated hormone. You can get it only if the doctor prescribes it.
They're going to take it off the market now. Don't say that. Don't say that. Don't say that. That and DHEA, right? And we could buy DHEA, progesterone, and
yeah,
melatonin
over
the market.
Yeah, no, that's also same here. So it's all prescription in Europe, or at least in Germany. I'm not quite sure if that's the case in all country, in all states of Europe, but in Germany it's all prescription. Great.
The website is Supversity, SUPPVERSITY.com, the single best blog to read if you're interested in anything that has to do with science that affects your body in any way. That's where you need to go. Adele, thank you so much for being on today.
Yeah, it was quite fun. I really missed that, but unfortunately I don't have that much time. So, but well, maybe we can make room for another science roundup in the weeks to come.
I would love that. I would love that a lot. You have a great evening, okay?
I will do that, yes.
Right.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Oh, you have a great day.
Yes, but it's still in the middle. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye. All right, so there you have it. What a great show. Could you believe 2 hours went by that fast? I just love having him on the show. He inspires critical thinking. He inspires original thought. One of my favorite guests of all time right there. And that's all we have today. We hope I hope you enjoyed today's show. And I hope you enjoy the lack of the radio spots that make you cringe. Please don't keep that stuff a secret. Let me know next time. And we'll see everybody tomorrow with more Superhuman Radio. Thank you for listening today.